safe to say this is one of the weirder parables. I have always carefully avoided this one. I looked up in our records. So has almost everybody else, except Jennifer Dietrich, preached on it once. I couldn't find a record of what she said. There she is, the only one brave enough. It's a story of a wealthy landowner who has a hired manager or a steward, perhaps hired, perhaps a slave. The way this worked was the landowner would have all sorts of properties, and who knows where this wealthy landowner lived. But locally there was a manager whose job it was to go to each of the tenants and to arrange how much would be paid to the landowner. All sorts of opportunity to, as we say, cook the books. Oh yes, you owe this much. And take a little bit more for himself. It says that it was being wasted. The master, though, at the end commends the dishonest manager. And Jesus says, "So I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth." What on earth are we supposed to do with this? Not only is Jesus sort of commending someone for dishonesty, the dishonesty involved doubling down on the landowner's losses, and yet he commends his manager. Luke had just shared one of the most beautiful parables ever told, treasured by people everywhere. Why on earth does he follow it up with this one? It seems unlikely, at least I hope it seems unlikely to you, that Jesus is commending that we make friends through theft or fraud or embezzlement. I don't think that's how we can take this passage. So what is Jesus saying? We would acknowledge that there's a very good chance that the stories that we hear today, the way we hear it, might have been heard very differently by Jesus' listeners in Roman Palestine. Even differently for the people of that region from how Jews or Greeks might hear it. And it's tempting for us to get stuck in the weeds, to focus on the parts that seem outrageous or confusing. And I want us to try and focus at least on what is clear. Now, a warning. Going back to the early church, there is no agreement on this passage. Everybody has recognized that this is really hard to make sense of. Jesus even seems to contradict himself in these words. So, be prepared to be unswayed. I know there's a lot of contrarians out there, so you're probably not going to like what I'm going to say. Brace yourselves. But I'm going to try. I think this much is clear. Jesus is commanding us to value people and to value living together and to value sitting at the table together above everything else. Jesus is commanding us to use whatever resources we have to work at relationships. Now, we can take the manager in one of two ways. The first, we can take it, we can read this story, and we can see that maybe the manager, by the end, has learned he should have been doing all along with the landowner's property. So by the end, there's redemption. That's one way of understanding this. The other way is that he's dishonest in the end. And if even a dishonest manager can use property for good ends, how much more ought Jesus' disciples, how much more ought Christians to use property for good ends? At the same time, I think it is possible that Jesus is also teaching us a few things about how we should look at money and our possessions. Any wealth, anything that we say, this is mine, we ought to understand it is not ours. We did not create it. We are merely stewards in the moment. Any wealth that we have is not an end in itself. We should not love our wealth or our possessions. Rather, we should recognize that we have been entrusted with whatever we have in money or possessions as a tool to bring us together, as a tool to serve other people, and never as a means to division. Now, how am I getting there? Maybe you already figured out, and that was obvious to all of you, but how was I getting there? First, I want to remember where Jesus is when he tells this story and to whom he is speaking. Did you notice? Who is with him? And what is going on? To find this, you actually have to scan back. You have to keep going back to the beginning of chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. This is what we were looking at last week. Do you remember how that section began? Tax collectors and sinners were coming to eat with Jesus. And Pharisees and scribes were appalled that Jesus would sit and eat with them. And if you remember, the dilemma is that tax collectors around the Roman Empire were not looked upon as favorably. As I said last week, you know, unlike today, where we love the tax man. But back then, there was a lot more room for dishonesty. The local tax collector determined how much to collect. And there was this sense that they were always taking more than they ought to be, and then passing some of it on to the Roman Empire and keeping some of it for themselves. On top of this problem, they were always interacting with Gentiles. And so, that caused conflict for them as Jewish people or for the Jews, because they were eating and spending time with Gentiles, they couldn't follow the Jewish rules, the Jewish laws of washing and sacrifices. So they were sort of doubly bad, not following the Jewish laws and dishonest people. And here Jesus was, this rabbi, this supposed great teacher and holy man, and here he is spending time with people who are known by everyone to be unclean, not following God's laws, not worshiping, not praying, and being dishonest, taking money that isn't theirs. What is Jesus doing? In today's lesson, it is still the same crowd that Jesus is speaking to, a very mixed group wanting nothing to do with each other. Last week, we reflected on three parables that Jesus told in response to seeing this conflict. Parables, stories about being lost and found. And you'll remember that each of these parables in chapter 15 ended with an invitation. Come in and join in the celebration. Join others at the table. Each story of being lost and found ended with that invitation. If you want to look back in chapter 15, you'll find it in verse 6. You'll find this invitation in verse 6, in verse 9, in verse 23. And then especially at the very last parable at the end, in verse 28 and 32, the father goes out to his son who is saying, I want nothing to do with this. And he says, the landowner says to his son, come in and join in the celebration. Come and sit down around the table. This chapter, chapter 16, verse 1, begins with a slight break. Then Jesus said to his disciples, is this a new crowd? Has he left everyone else behind? But if you scan down the page to verse 14, the Pharisees are still there. It's still the same crowd of people that Jesus is speaking to. It's still this crowd that doesn't trust each other, that wants nothing to do with each other. Jesus is addressing the same group in the same setting. And I don't think Jesus is introducing a new topic. I think he is approaching the division from a different perspective. Look through the parable. Did you hear the similarities between this parable and the parables in chapter 15? Look at what verse 4 says. The manager said, I have decided what I will do, so that people may welcome me into their homes. And then Jesus, in verse 9, adds a final comment on this parable. Make friends so that they may welcome you into their eternal homes. So the details of the story might seem strange, but I think this much is clear. Jesus is still asking us to think about sitting down at the table with people. What must we do to be right with each other? Come in and celebrate. He is still addressing the division in the crowds. He is still encouraging people to focus on what must we do to sit down together. If we didn't read the rest of this chapter, but if you do, if you keep reading, this theme of division and unity continues. Beginning in verse 19, Jesus is going to tell one more parable. And this time it's about a rich man sitting inside his wealthy home and a poor man starving and ill lying outside the gate, longing to be welcomed in to the table of the rich man and to share food there. And Jesus warns, this division that existed in life, if it's not dealt with, it lasts past death. Only the roles are reversed. And it is the rich man who is not able to sit down with the poor man at the side of Abraham. Chapter 15, 16, and 17, then, are all about the priority of relationships in the kingdom of God. And chapter 16 especially is a warning to us to ensure that money itself doesn't ever become the priority, that possessions never become the distraction, but that we understand that they are always tools given that we might build relationship with one another. Is it making sense so far? I don't see anybody shaking their heads quite yet. I think we have a further choice to make about how to view the servant. So let's note some similarities between this parable and the parable of the prodigal son. They're back to back, remember. Maybe you already see them, and maybe you're thinking, there are no similarities. Both involve someone squandering wealth that was not theirs. Now, if you want to get a picture of what this squandering looks like, I don't know if you've ever, you are better people than me, perhaps. Not even perhaps. You are. But, you know, if you've seen like a huge flock of seagulls, have you ever been tempted to run into the midst of them just to watch them scatter in all directions? At least as I've seen children do this with abandon, and they just, you know, they're all gathered together, the child runs in, and then hundreds of birds maybe scatter all over the place. This is the idea behind the word squander. It's that this is exactly what the younger son and the steward do. It is a picture of money being scattered freely in every which direction. In the parable of the lost son, it's the younger son who has squandered, who has wasted, who has scattered his father's money, the wealthy landowner. And now here in this parable, it is the manager or the steward who has taken his master's property and squandered and wasted it. And now there's a second similarity between these parables. In both of the parables, the turning point in the story is when the main character stops, pauses, and is honest with himself. And speaks to himself, begins to reason with himself. In the former parable, the parable we call the prodigal son, the younger son, it says in verse 17, came to himself and said, I know what I will do. I'm going to get up and I'm going to go back to my father. I'm going to tell him that what I've done was wrong, and I'm going to ask to be one of his servants. And in today's parable, the manager pulls away from the landowner. And he says to himself, what will I do? I have decided what I will do. And then finally, in both parables, there is the rich landowner, who I would argue cruelly has mercy on the one who has squandered all the wealth. The lost son has squandered, has scattered his father's property, and then returned and puts himself at his father's mercy. And the father, quite movingly and beautifully, has mercy on his lost son. In today's parable, does this happen as well? It isn't as obvious, which is why I've wanted to note all the other similarities. And look at the story. The steward has squandered his master's property, and he's called in. The master says, "What is this that I hear?" And the servant says, "Nothing." He is silent. Is it an admission of guilt? Something crooked has been happening. Now, what do you expect to happen next? Even today, we would expect charges to be laid, the police to be called, a proper investigation. We would expect this person who has been embezzling or stealing or committing fraud, you would expect that his property would be seized and confiscated so that there could be reparation. Roman law wasn't kinder than our law. It didn't take any more kindly to embezzlement or theft. The master would be well within his rights to imprison and even torture his servant, especially if this was not a freedman, but a slave, especially if this was not a Roman citizen. Anything could have happened to this steward. But instead, what happens? The wealthy landowner says, "You can no longer work for me." Now, Ken Bailey, who has a scholar and was for years and years, decades, was a pastor in the Middle East, has argued that at this point, the Middle Eastern listeners would have been surprised at the mercy of the master. They would have noted, this is an unusual action. The master has been quite merciful here. And then, Bailey argues, that the steward is operating out of the master's grace, knowing that he has just been extended grace and mercy. The NRSV, says, the steward acted shrewdly. Now, that word has a sneaky overtone to it, doesn't it? The King James Version puts it this way, that the steward acted wisely at this point. Other translations put it prudently. Possibly the servant is taking advantage of the master's mercy and going out and doing what? Forgiving the debt of others. Adjusting the books that he had cooked. Bringing their debts down. We call, at the end though, there's the problem of him being called a dishonest manager. Is that the final word on this person? To help us with that, consider that, what do we call the previous parable? The parable of the prodigal son. Even though we know that's not how that story ends. We know it ends with the son who is lost being found and coming home. Is that what's happening here? That Jesus is referring to this person who has come to be known for his unjust behavior, his unrighteous behavior, or his dishonest behavior. But is there redemption at the end of the story? Well, whether you think there is some redemption for the steward or not, some things that is clear. He was only a steward. All the wealth that he managed, all the wealth he enjoyed, it has been entrusted into his care. Like the son of the previous parable, the wealth was not his own. He was supposed to use it well. This is what many people in the early church emphasized. And they observed, the human tendency is to convince ourselves that every good thing that we have is something that we have earned, and now it is ours to use as we like. It is to convince ourselves that we are lords over our wealth and our possessions. We might call this today entitlement. To treat the things that are as ours to use as we like. I have worked, and now this is mine. I've heard people talk about how they treat their workplace sometimes. Calling in sick. Taking things that they figure no one will notice. I deserve this. You know, my boss is unfair. He makes so much money. The owner is so wealthy. It's only fair that I should take a little bit more. Or it's mine now to use as I please. To use it on myself if I like. But what these stories perhaps expose is the truth that nothing is our own. That all that we have depends on the work of others, the wealth of others being shared with us. And that ultimately all things are God's. All that we have is from God. And so we have a choice. Are we going to just build bigger barns to store up what we have? Are we just going to scatter what we've been given? Are we going to waste it? Or will we use what we have been given as a tool to bless the people around us? Are we going to use our possessions, whatever it is we have, as a means to build up relationships? One of the early preachers said, "Remember, you are but a dispenser of the things of others. The privileges granted to you are for a brief and passing use. Cast away from your soul, then, the pride of power and put on the humility and modesty of a steward." Another early preacher, commenting on this passage, said this, "O children of Abraham, buy for yourselves those things that do not pass away by means of these temporary things that are not yours." Augustine put it this way as well. If the steward who acted faithfully could be praised by his Lord, how much more can someone please God by working according to God's commandments? As the NAV puts it, in verses 11 and 12, Jesus says it this way. We have been entrusted with worldly wealth in this moment. However much or however little you have, these worldly things have been entrusted to you. They belong to someone else. Entrusted to you, will you be faithful with it? We hope to be entrusted with true riches one day, riches that will not go away. Can we be trusted with the possessions in this world? How are you using the things that you have? However little or however much they are, how are you using them today to satisfy yourselves? Or to bless others, to be a division between you and other people, or to bring you closer together? This is a season of Lent when we are asked to consider sacrificially giving to others of our time, of our possessions. It is a chance in Lent to reflect on our relationships with God and with one another. Are we right with one another? Or are we unright, unrighteous with one another? So let us be faithful. Even if we feel we have so little, let us be faithful with it. Let us be faithful with much. Either way, it is not our own. It belongs to our Master, who is gracious and merciful. The beginning of distancing ourselves from the love of money is to know God's love. The sustaining force behind loving others and loving God is knowing God's love more and more. And by loving God more than anything else,